transportation behavior, which relates to emissions, climate emissions, energy use, but also health, and also social capital, also the way that people are interacting, the way, you know, whether or not people meet each other outside of their cars, whether they recognize each other, whether they know their neighbors, all of these kind of things are going to be related to urban form. And indeed, energy use and material consumption also relates to urban form in places where people are. So there's a coupling between transport mode and the physical characteristics of houses. Right? So in suburbia, you have a large house, probably because a whole bunch of things which you would get from communal services or commercial services outside the house, you're trying to provide in your house. So you have your own gym, you have your own swimming pool, you have your own huge freezer where you store food instead of letting the local grocery store store it. You have a home entertainment, you know, etc. Mm-hmm. You have an industrial sized kitchen essentially, and you host dinner parties here in it rather than going out and using restaurants and so on. Mm-hmm. And all that's because you're removed from these communal high density mixed-use kind of neighborhoods. Anyway, so this is something we think is overlooked and is hugely important. The rate at which we are building out new cities, the rate at which humanity is moving to cities is probably peaking right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a one-time phenomenon, right? It's not something that's, I mean, in that sense it's a phase, because afterwards we will be living mostly in cities and we're never going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means we're also building up the fundamental infrastructure, the roads of these new cities. It's really a one-time process. I mean, global population is also going to peak, but you know, this move to cities is a one-time thing, and we can't undo roads. So the crazy thing about roads, not only do they underlie, they constrain all the subsequent urban development, which can change, but the roads don't change.
Mm-hmm.
So over timescales of hundreds of years, as it turns out, people don't actually erase roads and sort of recreate the layout, because
mm-hmm.
they can't. There's too many different landowners who are now spread out on them. So only for certain mega projects where you'd have a government actually buy up a strip of land at extreme expense and inconvenience, and so that's usually, you just don't see that. Anyway, so that's all, for a number of ways, we think that this rather critical thing, which is happening now and largely in an unregulated way, which is why we're concerned and want to understand it, that has impact on these human outcomes, including health, social capital, and all kinds of environmental outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's third thing that the original question was to do with
urban heat
health.
And social connectedness.
Okay, urban heat, yeah, I guess you can relate to, I mean, obviously to urban forms or something like that. No, then I could probably skip the last one. So I'm looking at energy transition in China, but that's specifically rural
mm-hmm.
and a bit suburban.
Mm-hmm.
And so there we're very interested in energy emissions and health, and of course we measure life satisfaction as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's everything but urban.
Okay. Great, thank you so much. The next question is, according to your paper, Sustainability and Well-being, a Happy Synergy, countries with the highest levels of social trust tend to be those with the strongest environmental protections. So according to that paper, what constitutes social trust?
Okay, so the statement you cited is qualitative, say.
Mm-hmm.
So what constitutes social trust is a broader concept, and I mean it in a broader way than the measures we have for it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something we have learned only, I would say, through the well-being literature, the happiness literature, how important these measures of trust are. And so we're still catching up in trying to measure the various dimensions of social capital, of
mm-hmm.
social identity, of belonging, all of these things, which are, you know, multidimensional, but they all seem to be incredibly important for life satisfaction and somewhat independently. So probably the more of them we measure, the more they will become important in our equations in some sense. I say that because, for instance, if you look at something like social identity, it turns out that people can feel like they belong to their local community.
Mm.
They can also feel like they belong to their city, province, or country. Now, those are very different things, and you might think that we have some kind of a limited amount of belongingness that we can feel.
Mm.
It turns out not. So the people who are happiest are the ones who feel they belong to every single layer, and you know, belonging to other groups, we actually are able to do that in parallel. So I can belong to an ethnic group, and I can belong to a sports group, and it seems like those belongings just add up in their benefit to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an example, just that that was to say that there are we don't measure something like social trust well. So that's the preface to say, here's the silly way we measure it. And the oldest way, and it's still common because it's old, if we measure something in the past, there's a value to sticking with it, even if it's a limited measure, because we can compare it over time, and that's the canonical to social trust question, is just something like, hey, do you think that people can be trusted in general, or that you can't be too careful with people?
Mm.
It's a dichotomous question. It's actually just, you know, yes, I think they can, or no. And so we know that for a lot of countries and over time. And so that measure, you know, it surprisingly explains a lot. It varies quite a bit. Although in the most trusting countries, you find a very high level of respondents say yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also ask other questions. Some of them are a little bit difficult to interpret, although so is a social trust question. So if I ask you on some kind of a Likert scale, meaning a qualitative discrete scale of very much to very little, how much would you say you trust your family, members of family? How much would you say you trust your neighbors? How much would you say you trust the police officer in your society? So we have those kind of measures. They also, you know, rank highly in Scandinavia, say, and other happy places. So you asked specifically about trust. So those are the flavor of trust questions. Although you can ask, so one of my favorite questions in the social capital realm, because it is, although you can ask it and people will give their opinions, it's actually something which is empirically accountable in the sense that, the meaning of the question is clear because you could run the experiment. And the question is, hey, if you were to lose a wallet with $50 in it, and it was found by a neighbor, or it was found by a stranger, or it was found by, again, a police officer, what's the chance that you would get it back?
Mm-hmm.
And so we might ask that by saying likely, you know, very likely, likely, not very likely, very unlikely, but those you could actually quantify if you wanted. And in principle, we're asking you to make a quantitative probabilistic prediction.
Mm-hmm.
And so sure enough, people have actually gone and done the experiment. You can do the experiment. Interestingly, I don't know how many places this is true, but I bet it's true many places. In Toronto, if you do the experiment, you get much more positive results than people's predictions. So if you ask the question, people think majority of wallets will not come back.
Mm.
And in reality, something like 85% come back with money.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
So what does that mean? Well, the thing that matters most for subjective well-being is actually the belief, not the reality.
Mm.
So why is there a gap? Why are we living in a society in which people are more pessimistic about crime and about honesty of others than reality?
Mm-hmm.
That's a cheap thing to fix. Right? So clearly there's something giving us a systematic bias towards being afraid of other people, and I suspect that's because of it's politically expedient for certain people to sell those stories. And also it probably sells, it makes money in the press to focus on those stories. In any case, that's something which in principle we could fix and probably have a big benefit on lobbying. So, but your question was these countries that tend to have happy societies, they tend to have high trust.
Mm-hmm.
There is a footnote to that, which I would say, you know, we still are in the process of fully understanding. and that is there are some places with anomalously low trust, even though they have relatively high life satisfaction, and we're living at one of them. So Quebec has pretty happy residents, but on some measures of trust, we still score lower than you would expect. And so people have worried about that. In the same way they have worried about cultural comparisons of life satisfaction question, which have mostly, I would say, in some sense, been put to rest broadly. You know, you also have to worry about whether there are, well, just, you have to worry about whether the relationship between, let's just say, to be transparent, between answers to a trust question and answers to a life satisfaction trust question, you need to worry about whether that relationship is invariant across cultures.
Cool. Okay. And that is that's correlated to the amount of environmental protections that countries have. Is there any explanation or a possible explanation behind the correlation of high social trust and lots of environmental protections?
So I made this comment, and I mean, there are very few countries, so it's always hard to talk about country comparisons unless you have well constrained the number of potential explanatory variables, right? But so in this case, I don't think I've even really myself used a measure of of foreign policy or of environmental legislation or something like that. I may have, but I don't remember doing that and looking at the correlation. But sort of anecdotally, if you look at a list of the countries who are, you know, had the earliest carbon taxes, who have highest foreign aid levels as a fraction of GDP, who are proactive in international treaties, conservation treaties, climate treaties, they happen to be, looks like, similar, have a lot of crossover with the countries which are high on measures of trust. So that's actually, anything else I say about that is going to be speculation, although probably well-founded, right? But it makes sense that people who have a pro-social, so there's a few things, people have a pro-social attitude within their society, within the people who they interact with regularly, are likely to have that spill over to humanity more broadly. They're also used to the idea that we can solve our problems, our big problems, by coming together collectively. And I think that's something that distinguishes some of the same countries, and I would say even distinguishes Quebec a little bit in a North American context, is that there is an expectation, understanding, experience that we can actually make ourselves better off by coming together, thinking about a problem collaboratively, and implementing collective solutions, which is really, it's extremely basic in economic thinking, right? You solve collective action problems by enforcing new rules on yourself. And those new rules, although they take away freedoms from everybody, typically, they make every single person better off. This is the magic of something called the collective action problem economics. And so some societies have a sort of a gut understanding of the benefits of coming together and thinking creatively, pro-socially, and collaboratively.
Great, thank you. I think the next question's a little bit too broad, but let's see. So, in your paper, Informing Policy Priorities Using Inference from Life Satisfaction Responses in a Large Community Survey, you state that policies should be designed to encourage the development of increased social capital within communities, and that these policies should be evaluated and prioritized based on human-centered outcomes. So one of Montreal's goals in their plan, Sustainable Montreal 2016 to 2020, is to ensure access to sustainable, human-scale, and healthy neighborhoods. And some of the actions, two of the actions is, one of them is protect, restore, and enhance Montreal's heritage and The second one is support the development of local culture. Do you think these will be effective in reaching this goal of having sustainable human scale and healthy neighborhoods? They're kind of broad actions, but.
Effective in what? Achieving? Do I think they will be effective? That's a predictive question, so I don't know anything about those policies.
Okay.
Except for the names.
Okay.
What's the value of celebrating, building awareness of, etc., heritage? I think it's, if it's inclusive, it should be good from what I know. So it seems like we like to be part, we like to belong. And that belonging, I think, is, it's not just defined by a group that we belong to of actual individuals. It's also defined by a story and by a future and by continuity and therefore by past. I think having, having a story can help to build identity, collective community identity. In Quebec we have, that seems like a nuanced issue, because if you celebrate identities and history, and patrimony, which doesn't include everybody in some sense, that might not be so. That might have some counterproductive effects as well. I think it's an interesting question. If you wanted to build community, to what extent should you be doing that based on celebrating history, as opposed to the other ways you can define community? Mm. I mean, one of the we know from natural experiments say that facing adversity together can be a very powerful way of building community. So if communities which already have the sort of sufficient basis for coming together to solve their problems in the way I just mentioned, then if you throw even a natural disaster at them, it can actually strengthen all kinds of social capital, right? So bonds, collective thinking, institutions, trust, and identity. So I sort of wonder sometimes about this. In Montreal we have a lot of heritage. We have heritage buildings, we have history, which is very important to identity of some here, but we also have a lot of newcomers. And I always wonder about the value of building identity off the historical stuff versus a forward-looking identity. Mm. What would happen if we redefined ourselves or defined ourselves based on new ideas? And in fact, a relevant one. So, we are a city where we value X, Y, and Z, and actually promote that in a way that people take it on, become proud of it, and advertise it outwardly. I think you might be able to get just as far with that. So, for instance, I think it would be interesting if Montreal took on an identity of a place where, this is a bit circular to the subject matter, but where we value these human-centered outcomes as what we are trying to promote here, right? This kind of stuff, it's actually not, it shouldn't be new or radical anymore. If you look back in the early 1990s, mid-1990s, when Enrique Peñalosa started a revolution as mayor of Bogota, and his revolution was, among other things, a war against cars, and he wanted to just really transform the level of equity and dignity for all, and access to common resources, including parks, streets, transportation. And so in order to do that, he had to promote the idea. This is his platform, I think, on which he got elected. That we're not going to win the GDP race. We're not going to be the richest society or the richest city. We're not going to be as rich as the United States overnight. That's not how we're going to define ourselves. We're going to define ourselves as a place where we have a good life, where we're happy. And here's how I think we can achieve that. So that's a revolution I'm still, you know, looking forward to seeing be the norm around the world at all levels of government. But I think Montreal's actually in a great position to have a little bit of that kind of self-definition of identity building along similar lines. What's special about Montreal? Many things, but we could be the first really large city to say, hey, our government is going to be, in principle, our policies are going to be accountable to how good life feels to its citizens. Which is really, you know, as I said, it's not new, but it is still radical nowadays. And if done right, I think that's something that we could really internalize as residents of Montreal and be proud of and sell, you know.
Great, thank you again. Let's check if this is still recording. Okay, well, sorry about this. It's good. That's real quick. Yes, good. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so next question is, in your other paper, evaluating the short-term costs of low-level local air pollution, a life satisfaction approach, you found that higher air pollution significantly reduces life satisfaction, and as expected, the adverse effect of pollution on well-being is considerably higher for individuals having a poor health condition. So this, in short, highlights the fact that there are individuals that are more vulnerable to detrimental environmental factors than others. Very broadly, how would you suggest that we accommodate to the greater needs of vulnerable populations when creating environmental policies, whether it be for air quality or otherwise?
And you're thinking in a Montreal context?
It could be broader.
I mean, this is an amazing field right now because I would say that our understanding of the importance of local air pollution has largely been the domain of environmental epidemiologists who are looking for various kinds of markers and health incidents and health outcomes. And maybe even, so I'm going out, you know, I could be wrong on this, but my impression is that's, like most medicine, been somewhat focused on physical health, and at least mental health has been the brain part of things has been siloed or separated or maybe neglected, and some of the studies now are using these new methods to, and so you can do cost benefit analysis in this, right? I mean, and the way you do that in health is you say, well, here's the value in healthcare savings or in how much people seem to value living longer of reducing pollution. Okay, so you can actually come up with an economic value, economic benefit to reducing pollution of certain levels. Now, we're coming up with these new ways to do that, and some of the results are a little hard to believe, except that the methods used are very rigorous. So one of these is to use life satisfaction to, which, you know, it's sensitive in a very different way, but it comes up with these really large effects. And so even in places in Canada where we don't have a huge local pollution problem by by global standards, by historical standards, we still found these very significant effects on life satisfaction for non-rare levels of local pollutant. There are other studies now which look at cognitive effects of pollution, and they seem to be enormous. So it seems like these low levels of of PM2.5 can really make us dumber and less productive. And it's it's really remarkable. And there are now even studies that, I think this is still in the review process, but there are these really remarkable econometric studies which have where we can actually isolate causal effects. So we really use very clever use of natural variation in order to isolate the causal effect, and it looks like, again, low levels of pollution may have enormous effects on the economy, largely through people's productivity. So I'm losing track a little bit of the question, but so that the paper, so the life satisfaction approach, as it's called, for this kind of thing, is one new way to get at these cost benefit questions. And for me, it's in some sense the ultimate one, because I don't care about productivity of the economy except insofar as it's important for life satisfaction. What does that tell us about how to, you said, make sure there's some, be sensitive to environmental equity issues or something. And as I've blathered with that background, I'm not sure that I've really stalled enough to come up with a sensible answer, because there are, to be sort of pedantic about it, the curve, the dose response curve matters, right? So is it the first, microgram per cubic meter that matters the most, or is the second one just as bad as the first? In some sense, that matters for distributional questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you made reference, it also matters if people who have, say, pre-existing respiratory challenges are more susceptible to. Anyway, look, we're in Canada, right? The priority, in terms of local pollution, we don't have big industry. We don't have emissions really much coming from big industry in Montreal. Most of the exposure here to, say, PM2.5 is from cars.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly, and so my short answer is, come on, let's get rid of internal combustion engine cars. We can actually do that on a very short time scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you can worry about distributional effects of, say, as an example, PM2.5, but don't put too much effort into that, because we should just get rid of the PM2.5 in
mm-hmm.
a few years.
Okay, great.
Mind. Now, on the other hand, interestingly, because it seems like not many people realize this yet, the emissions are not all out of the tailpipe. So
mm-hmm.
cars also produce emissions from their brakes and from tires on the road.
Oh.
So this is still, there are people at McGill who are working on this stuff. Not all PM2.5 particles are equal. The chemistry really matters for biological effectiveness and interference. So anyway, electric cars still have tires. And electric cars, fortuitously, don't use frictional braking very much. They actually use magnetic braking. So they also produce less of those particles. Okay, but while we're getting rid of internal combustion engine cars, let's also make sure that the public transportation fills, and active transportation, I should say, and public transportation fills the gap, not just more electric cars.
Mm.
Anyway, so that's a cop-out answer. Local pollution, and so there's a Montreal answer, but this is an absolute emergency in India, in China, in Iran, in all kinds of places. There again, I'm not answering the question at all, but it's an emergency, and the policies are on every front trying to reduce those levels for everybody.
Thanks.
One thing that comes out of data is that because low levels matter, yes, people who are health compromised are going to have more acute effects, but because even low levels matter, everyone is suffering. There's
mm-hmm.
nobody escaping this, and you go somewhere where it's polluted, and it's once you've seen what these effects are in some of these research, it's mind-blowing to think that we're living like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really top priority in a lot of places.
Understood. Yeah. Does the friction, because that was interesting, I've never heard that before, but does the friction on bike tires, is it the same? I'm sure it's on a smaller scale.
So rims are Are they sometimes aluminum or are they always steel? I guess they're usually some kind of alloy. And then rubber are the brakes. Well, no, there's also disc brakes. So there it's actually it's metal on one side and metal on the other. So anyway, those kind of frictions are also producing small particles. Yeah. But yeah, good point. So we'll not in e-bikes. In e-bikes, those are again magnetic. That's interesting. And of course, the braking that you do on a bicycle is absolutely tiny because you're always dealing with less inertia, less mass at the beginning. So that would be a good thing to quantify. But surely the trucks and the cars are producing orders of magnitude more particles from braking than bikes ever will.
Yeah. Okay. That was just an off-the-topic tangent question. It's very interesting. So this will be the last question. So your work does a great deal with large open access data sets and high resolution spatial data. Has this practice made its way into policymaking of your knowledge? And if not, what steps could be taken to consistently create data-driven policies?
That's nice. So has policy... let me try and... articulate those questions. So one of them, can I say, are governments using large and open data sets?
Yeah, open access, high resolution, spatial data sets, yeah.
They are.
Okay.
I mean, data science is just booming in governments, or at least that, I'm sure it's everywhere. It is everywhere. But Canada is you know, stitching data sets together and building large and high resolution data sets everywhere you look. I mean, every department. And what's that got to do with keeping policy accountable to data? I like the question. I don't know. So if the government is, I mean, anyone who's producing more data that's easily accessible, that's going to help keep governments accountable because of the role that light and transparency has on government policy. So do you have something more in mind about how that might work?
Not quite sure. So I'm not very well. I'm not as well informed as you, I'm sure. I wasn't aware that a lot of governments were using this like large data sets, and
they often have their own.
Yeah. Okay.
So they're not all open necessarily.
Okay.
But they're also increasingly open in the end. But even having an open data set within government is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a good Montreal story. They had City of Montreal had I've interrupted you, so I want to come back. But they had an open data initiative a few years ago. Can't remember how long ago that was now.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these departments had to go through, you know, probably an awful lot of bureaucratic effort to figure out what data they had that could be opened up. And when all said and done, who is using all the data that was open? It was almost all internal. So it meant that one department could now access data from another department with all kinds of benefits, both in data and presumably other, you know, presumably that had trickle-down effects in terms of cooperation and coordination and so on. So governments are enormous and they're siloed themselves, and so actually even opening data internally can be valuable. Anyway, so but I interrupted your. What are your thoughts on how that might work?
Yeah.
The accountability.
Yeah, I've been reading through some policies, some like bylaws that have to do with specifically urban heat, but it doesn't seem like even if they do have these like large data sets, like I don't know exactly how they are able to get that data across or the information that the can be derived from that data across effectively towards the policymakers themselves and also the general public in these reports. I'm seeing kind of a disconnect. So I'm not sure exactly how the government can, maybe by making it more open access, giving like maybe spatial maps that are accessible to the public. And easily understandable, because people aren't gonna just look at a bunch of numbers. They're gonna wanna see something that's easily understandable. So if they do have large data sets, making it easily understandable by just the average Joe, possibly, and for, I don't know, during policy, making policy that's directly based on those numbers, that data, because I'm not sure exactly, because a lot of other environmental policies that I read, not just Montreal, like a lot of the goals are just abandoned after a while. They never make, you know, update reports, and it's kind of just all these promises that fall by the wayside. So if these policies are more based on concrete data sets, I feel like that would be more effective. I'm not sure to what extent in Montreal that this has been put into place, but.
That's an interesting thing to think about, and also to, you know, figure out how to assess. I mean, even if it's not the governments who are making data easily digestible for the non-specialist, if they make them open, then that will happen anyway, right? So other people will both bring them to bear on past policy to try to assess whether changes have responded, whether measures have responded appropriately to policy, and also then for projection into the future. Understanding the past can also require models, but for projecting into the future to inform new policy, that's also something that can happen outside government. I mean, you know, if the data are released, then outside players can come and say, hey, would you, you know, you have models, we also have models, and it's the basis of collaborations, which good governments are very encouraging of, especially because, you know, capacity and resources are usually always limited in government, and so that's one reason we have people with freedom to take on new things in academia. I don't know if there needs to be any sort of top-down structure or coordinated way to increase accountability. I mean, if the data are there, the accountability will follow, because, you know, if you have a study and it's based on government data, that's, the government can't reject that unless it finds real flaws in your method. So I think the rest kind of happens as well as probably it can, as long as you have academic freedom and strong enough to civil society that people are, somebody is able to do that work.
Great. Thank you. So last of my questions, this was very informative, and I learned a lot even just in this short period. Thank you so much.
Great questions you had.